The financial planners are in the house with a look at some year-end planning advice because, well, it's that time of year. But we'll begin with a conversation with the planners about how the Fed's long-awaited decision last week to raise interest rates will affect you. The Federal Reserve raised the Fed funds rate by a quarter point. This was the first rate increase since June 2006. Our financial planners are Lucas Butchel is a principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, welcome back.
Thank you.
Sandy Weaver's a CPA and owner of Financial Security Advisors. Sandy, good morning to you.
Morning, Steve.
And David Jackson is with the Financial Planning Association. David, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Okay, the decision to raise rates, Sandy, was hardly a surprise, was it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely not. I think the market had priced in something like a 75% expectation that they would before the meeting.
No, Lucas, the Fed went out of its way, it strikes me, to, you know, sort of hint, and hint it again that a rate increase was on its way. Why? Why does it do that?
I think they wanted the market to not be surprised. I think there was had been some mixed signals earlier this year. A lot of people thought they would raise rates in September. That didn't happen. And I think it kind of riled the markets a little bit. And I think the Fed had wanted to get off of zero for some time. And I think they wanted everybody to know that the way there were no surprises this round.
Well, why not surprise people? Why is that so important not to surprise people?
I think because it allows market participants to prepare for it. And it if the expectations kind of meet what the Fed does, it really reduces the amount of volatility that you see in both the stock and bond markets.
And nobody likes volatility, right?
Exactly.
David, how did the markets react to this increase once the Fed finally made it official?
Well, it was kind of strange how it played out because the day that they announced, the stock market actually went up when most experts seemed to think that it was going to go down. But then the next couple of days after that, then the market went down. So it's really hard to say, you know, like Lucas was saying, a lot of it has been priced in and it was not a surprise. But still, the market does not like change, and so you know we are expecting a little bit of volatility to come aboard.
You know, the market, it just obviously so hard to predict. There are days when you think some world crisis is happening somewhere, and the markets are up, and you would just swear that they'd be dropping on some development like that.
You know, and what's weird about it is that sometimes the market will drop because of good news, and you know, and then vice versa will happen. So it's really hard to get any kind of handle on what really is driving it.
Yeah. You know, Sandy, it strikes me as kind of strange here. This rate increase we're talking about was 0.25%, and yet it's being sort of seen and hailed as a big deal. And I'm wondering why.
It's because of, you know, for 7 years we've been on zero. And all of a sudden, instead of being accommodative, now the Fed has switched and they're going to be more restrictive now. This is a first of several steps in that direction.
So the sense is now that there'll be more increases going forward, small
yes.
step increases.
Yes, exactly.
And that's happening why? What's the Fed's thinking?
Because the economy is doing pretty well here in the U.S. You know, we have unemployment at 5% or lower. Wage inflation is just starting to show up. But we have some pretty good numbers on our economy. So the Fed wants to get in front of that and make sure that things don't get out of hand.
Well, Lucas, we hear the economy is doing well, but then the political rhetoric, and maybe that's, you know, because it's political rhetoric, would seem to suggest that the economy is sluggish. It's really not picking up at the pace we'd like to see it picking up. The jobs report every month, you know, 200,000 jobs is like, okay, it's not great. So given that, why the increases?
And I think to your point is that is exactly the experience we're having right now. It has been kind of positive and everything seems to be moving in the right direction, but it's not as fast as everybody would like it to be. And so, you know, the politicians, of course, you know, turn that into, you know, there's bad policy currently and here's what I would do differently to accelerate things. But I think the reason the Fed needs to act or the reason they did is because they want to be in front of inflation. So that really the Fed is charged with two things. Number one is keeping stable prices in the economy, meaning managing inflation. And the second is kind of full employment. So we've pretty much hit the full employment number. As Sandy mentioned, we're at 5% or slightly less. That's about where the Fed considers, you know, roughly full employment. And so then the second piece is inflation. Inflation has really been tame, and it's been tame for a long time. We're just starting to see some signs, though, that we may be on an uptick. So wage inflation is probably one of the the most key indicators there, and that's just starting to tick. And so what the Fed doesn't want to do is get behind the eight ball on inflation, and then they have to move quickly. So this is seen as a way to get the process started. That way they can be more gradual with the process.
Again, you're saying we're at full employment, but a lot of folks, again, might be thinking about political rhetoric. And the thinking there is that, hey, so many people have been unemployed for so long. There's this big pool of people out there who want to get jobs, but they can't because there aren't that many jobs out there, and they've been out of the pool so long that they don't count in the employment stats any longer. So is that still the case? I mean, are we still looking at lots of folks out there who want to get employed?
I think that is there is a case there. I think what you're seeing now is the folks that are in that position, there's a mismatch of skills to the jobs that are out there. So there's more job openings. There's positions now that have been open longer. But the problem is the people that are looking for work don't have the skills that match the jobs that are available. So there needs to be a retraining, a refitting in order to match that up. And no matter what environment we're in, whether we're in a really accelerated growth environment, there's always going to be some level of unemployment. And that's what the Fed looks at. You'll never get to a zero unemployment level, but the Fed's looking at a level that seems to be a one that you normally would see when you're at a period of decent economic growth and a comfortable level for them.
You know, David, this all strikes me as a whole bunch of hubbub over a quarter of 1% rate increase. It's so small. Why even bother?
Well, it's not the percent. It's the direction. So like Sandy,
it's the signal being sent here.
Right. As Sandy alluded to, we've been in a zero interest rate environment for several years now. And so finally, the Fed is saying we need to get back to normal because zero is not normal. It's nowhere close to being normal. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that we know interest rates are going to start trending up just alerts us that, number one, the economy has gotten a whole lot better. You know, so the government does not feel they need to provide stimulus anymore. They feel like the economy can stand on its own. And then the other side of it is, so what does that mean to everybody else? But the quarter percent in it of itself does not mean much at all. It's just the fact that it is going up finally.
It's all the bells and whistles wrapped around it then, it sounds like.
Well, partially. You know, but you think about in Europe, after the recession, Europe kind of did the opposite of the United States. They decided austerity is the way to go. And so Europe stayed in a recession much longer than the United States did because of austerity. The United States
spent a bunch of money through the stimulus package, right. And you're saying that helped us pull out of this
Exactly. So now we're starting to let that go, whereas Europe is doing just the opposite. Now they're trying to be a lot more accommodative. Is that the word?
Accommodative. You're close.
You're in the ballpark.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. I live in that world, David, believe
me.
It's about 400 words I wish I had back over the years. Well, Sandy Weaver, so what's the impact on regular folks out there now that the rates are starting to jump up again?
Well, it's two-sided coin. Bad news is on the income side, you know, don't expect to start reaping, you know, gobs of money from your CDs and savings accounts. Those are probably going to just sit where they are. Money markets even aren't going to, you know, the rates on that isn't going to budge enough that you'd notice. But on the expense side, you know, prime jumped now to 3.5%. And so on the expense side, you'll notice it in your variable rate loans, like your auto loans, most of your credit cards. If you have a variable rate mortgage, you might see that start to move. Mm-hmm. So on that side, you'll see it more than the income side yet.
You know, Lucas, when banks, you know, offer, you know, they get this money from the Fed at such a low interest rate, why can't regular people get money at rates like that?
I think the rate that the Fed sets is really the rate that banks can borrow from each other overnight. And the way the system is designed is that, you know, that's for big institutions. So what they want is individuals going to banks to borrow those dollars. Now, if the banks have really cheap access to capital, you know, they would be able to lend out money at hopefully a lower cost. And that really has been the case. Question about can individuals or should individuals be able to go directly to, you know, the Federal Reserve and borrow money? I think it's the design is just completely different. The design for individuals to go through the banking institutions, not the Fed.
Well yeah, but why can't we change it so it helps regular folks like me? Why am I paying 3.75% for my mortgage when banks are borrowing money for, you know, next to nothing?
You know, I think there's it's an element of
someone's making
risk.
A lot of money on Steve Kraske here.
Well, I think the
story of my life, by the way. But yeah,
there's a risk premium built in there. So as an individual, there's some risk to the institution and to the system at large. You know, that you may not be able to pay that back. For a large institution in a really short amount of time, overnight lending, the amount of risk that's being taken is much smaller. Nothing personally, Chris.
Should I be satisfied with that, Sandy?
Well, the other thing is, you know, you and I are peanut players. You know, we borrow maybe 10 grand for a car or 100 grand for a house, and a bank will go out and borrow, you know, billions.
Right.
You know, so there's processing time on you and me, mm-hmm. whereas a bank, you know, there's not. You know, so the banks have to make a margin too. But the other half of the equation more so actually is the risk element.
Well, I'm going to sit here for a while, David. I mean, why is someone making 3.75% on my money when banks are getting by at 0.25% or around there? That's a pretty big spread.
That's
3.5 points.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just really.
And I'm just going to say it for all the world to see. I pay my debts, so there's no risk with me.
I think you want to jump in. Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, there is some risk with you because your mortgage is how long?
Well, it's 5 years now.
Okay, so but when you took it out, it was probably
it was 10 or 15. Yeah.
So you're borrowing for a long period of time, and the institution locked that rate in for you at mm-hmm. you know 3.25, 3.5. For 10 years. When these banks are borrowing from each other, from the Fed, it's overnight. So their borrowing period is one day. So the amount of time that they've given you a fixed rate loan is significantly longer than they can borrow from each other.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that's the answer, right? I gotta be satisfied with that. Okay. Let's move on here. I'm wondering what else this might mean for savers going forward. Again, you're saying, Sandy, you're not going to see
much.
Pops in your interest rates. Nothing big's going to happen there.
Yeah, not much.
And so many senior citizens are hoping for a pop in their interest rates, and they're not going to get it here.
Probably not. Yeah. Not right now.
Yeah.
But again, I think the bigger piece is it's directional. So as the Fed continues to raise rates, as shorter term rates continue to move up, which we expect over time, then you will start to see those short term rates for CDs, for savings accounts. Those should start to creep up as we get back to that more normal monetary policy that David mentioned.
So the
it's been so tough on the senior citizens that you were kind of alluding to.
Yeah.
And the fact, you know, you think about somebody who did a financial plan way back when, and they said, okay, if I have $1 million and I put it in a CD and I'm earning 5% on it, that's $50,000 a year just of interest, mm-hmm. and I'm fine. Mm-hmm. And then when the CD rates went from 5% down to 1% or less than 1%, all of a sudden that $50,000 a year was now $10,000 or less.
Or seven, yeah.
And so you had a choice to make at that point of, okay, do I start pulling money out of my principal to keep the $50,000, or do I just live on the $10,000 or less, or do I take more risk? And so for the seniors, it has been a really, really tough dilemma trying to figure out how do I navigate this. And so just the fact that they know over time, and it's not going to happen in the short run, like Sandy mentioned,
right.
It's going to take a while. But eventually those rates will get back more to a normal 5% or so.
Well, if that's the case, Sandy, then I don't want to lock in my money right now because rates are going up. So don't lock in now.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Right.
Yeah.
Because if you can wait it out, if you can afford to, you know, without extending maturities, then, yeah, you know your interest rates are going to be going up for a few years here.
Okay. And for stock investors, Lucas, what does this mean for them? Because typically when interest rates go up, stocks tend to suffer. Is that what we're seeing, what we expect to see?
I don't think so right away, but I think eventually as the Fed continues on this path, I think you will see that be a headwind for stocks. I think initially it's almost the opposite in terms of a vote of confidence by the Fed in our economy. So to your point, the narrative out there has been very much a sluggish, you know, slow growth. We haven't really recovered as well as we'd like. But I think what the Fed is really saying here, reading between the lines, is that we think the U.S. economy is at a good place and on a good path. And as a result, we're more comfortable now starting to shift our policy. That should be a good thing. If you've had less than high expectations, I think you can feel a little bit better about where the U.S. economy is. So that should act as a kind of a confidence boost. And especially markets and short-term trading, confidence is important. And so I think as we move into next year, it should be a good signal. But I think eventually, assuming the Fed does continue to raise rates, even, you know, gradually, what that does is it helps restrain inflation. It helps hold back economic growth just a little bit. And that over time should be probably a not so good thing for stocks.
Yeah, David.
Well, it's been two different economies that we've been looking at over the last several years where, you know, from one standpoint, the economy has been doing really, really well. But for the average guy out there who's making an hourly wage, their income has not been going up. But then the guy or the gal who's mm-hmm. getting paid by the hour, they have not been seeing nice pay increases to keep up with the cost of everything else. So, and that's one of the things the Fed has been monitoring really, really closely, and they're finally starting to see signs that wages are starting to go up a little bit. And that gives them the confidence to say, okay, we can start raising interest rates. But for a long time, we've had two different economies, one that says things were looking good, and the other was saying, hey, no, we're still kind of stuck in a recession.
Yeah. Okay, let's move into sort of the second segment of our show here today, which is year-end financial planning. And by all means, if our listeners want to call in with a question, we've got three terrific experts here who can help you with some year-end financial planning advice and decisions. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's get started here in some basic things that people might want to be thinking about to reduce their tax liability. Sandy, how would you open up a conversation there?
Couple things, I guess. If you're going to give a charitable donation, give it in appreciated securities instead of cash out of your bank. So you might.
What's the difference there?
Let's say that I want to give away $3,000, and instead of writing a check from my bank account, I'm going to choose something in my portfolio that's gone up 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you crunch the numbers on that, that actually saves you in taxes $225.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you sold that and then paid the tax and then gave the $3,000, you know, so it's always a smarter idea to give away appreciated securities, whether that's a stock or a mutual fund. Second thing I would think about is go through in my taxable accounts that are at the brokerage. If I have losses, you know, I might want to sell those, especially if I can offset income with that.
I was going to say you can write off the losses,
yes,
right?
Yes, right. Yeah. And then in January, you can think about, do I really want to go back into that company or that mutual fund? Is it a good thing or not? But right now, you want to get that loss booked and sent to the tax return.
Okay. Well, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about year-end financial planning. We'll get your questions, too, at 816-235-2888. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Hear our show featuring the best music of 2016 at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, the political pundits join us for a look at the big issues of 2015 and give us some insights into what will make some political headlines next year. There's going to be a bunch in 2016. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. This hour, we're visiting with our financial planners, Lucas Butchel with KHC Wealth Management, Sandy Weaver, owner of Financial Security Advisors, and David Jackson with the Financial Planning Association. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number. Yvette from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question regarding ESOP benefits that I have available. I'm changing jobs here in the next day or two and have about $75,000 in ESOP available. What should I do with that? I believe there's penalties, fees if I cash any of it in. Can I cash in part of it, or what should I roll it over into?
And what's ESOP before we go any further?
Employee-owned.
Yeah. Stock ownership plan.
Thank you.
I see. Yeah. Yeah, great. Any wisdom here?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. One of the first things I would do it would be to talk to your employer and find out what options they're offering. You may be required to sell out as a leaving employee. Typically, I think you'd want to look to roll that over unless you really want to have the opportunity to stay a part of the ownership of that company. But in most cases, they're going to want you, if you're no longer going to be an employee, to sell the stock and then take those funds and roll it to somewhere else.
Yeah, Sandy.
And again, I agree with Lucas. You should go back to your human resource people and ask. But lots of times they'll buy you out, and they'll only let you, they will buy you out over a period of time. And sometimes you may not be allowed to roll over, but usually what we've seen is that they'll buy you out on their schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good luck, Yvette. Hope it works out.
It will. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye. We were going to talk in our first half about the impact on bonds, David Jackson, on with the interest rates going up higher. What are your thoughts and concerns there?
Well, there has been a lot of conversation about how in a rising interest rate environment, the effect that has on bonds. And so there have been a lot of people on the fence on bonds for the last couple of years waiting for the interest rates to start going up. And so now we're there. So I wanted to just kind of paint a real simple picture of why bonds react negatively to higher interest rates. So if you have a bond that's paying 5%, let's just say, and as interest rates have gone up, new bonds with the very same risk profile are now paying 6%, then who wants your 5% bond if you can get a new one for 6%? Well, the only way they'd want it is if you sold it at a discount. So that is what happens with bonds in a rising interest rate environment, which doesn't mean that bonds are a bad investment. It just means people need to understand that as interest rates rise, it may have a negative impact on bonds. And a lot of the seniors that I was kind of talking about before who said, well, with CD rates being so low, maybe I should move my portfolio more into bonds and take a little bit more risk. Well, now they're dealing with another type of risk that they may have to eventually reconcile.
Well, in a rising interest rate environment, then, why aren't bonds always a bad investment?
Well, you can't say always, because new bonds are going to be paying a slightly higher dividend. And so it just kind of depends. And if you have an old bond, then you need to understand that the dividend is still being paid, but the value of the bond itself may be going down. So your total return is not going to be quite as much as
robust
much
as you hope, Lucas. Yeah.
Yep. And just to add to that, I think the speed at which rates rise really determines how good or bad a bond investment is. And then the other thing is, the longer the maturity a bond is, the more sensitive it is to rate increases or decreases. So longer-term bonds will be more impacted as rates change than shorter-term bonds.
Why is that?
It's just a function of the discount method and the formula on it.
Let's say you have a bond. You know, back to David's example. You know, you have a bond that's 5%, and the new ones are 6%. So nobody wants your bond. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you're going to be stuck in that deal for 2 years versus if you're going to be stuck in that bad deal for 20 years, depends. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
How much of a hit
mm-hmm.
you're going to take.
Oh, that's interesting. Again, if you want some year-end financial advice, your questions welcome. 816-235-2888. What are some other overlooked deductions, Lucas, that people might want to think about as they look down the gum barrel here towards the end of 2015?
Yeah, a really common one that we see a lot that people don't know exists is if you're volunteering your time as part of charitable work, you can deduct the travel, the mileage to and from the volunteering activity. And so if you are going to travel and go to work with the charity, track your mileage and take a logbook, and you'll be surprised if you are an active volunteer how much that will add up. There's a particular mileage rate that the IRS puts out that you can deduct as part of your charitable deductions on your taxes for the mileage you drive to volunteer. Another one that a lot of people don't think is worth their time to track is donating, you know, stuff to Goodwill or Salvation Army, so household items when you're doing some spring cleaning or things like that. And I would always encourage folks to make sure you're kind of keeping those receipts and deducting. You know, if you're at 500 or less, the requirements for kind of substantiation of that stuff is pretty minimal, and a lot of people just don't do that. But that's an easy deduction to take that a lot of people just don't think is worth their time.
Sort of an automatic $500 discount off your gross income, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. 816-235-2888. Kathy from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you, Kathy.
I wanted to tell you what a difference a couple hours made. I was applying for a home equity line of credit with Bank of America, and they had a special that's been going on for probably a year where it was 1.99% interest for the first 12 months. And I got my paperwork in before the Feds raised the rate, and I thought I was locked in. But unfortunately, just the next day when the rates raised, my home equity line of credit interest jumped from 1.99 to 2.37, I believe. So,
wow.
It when you're a day late, you really are a dollar short on something.
Good point, Kathy. Did you have a question, too?
No, I just wanted to make that comment. I find that it's it was pretty quick that things happen. So just kind of keep an eye on the market if you're thinking about doing anything financially.
Just like gas prices.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, just like gas prices, they go down a lot slower than they go up.
Yeah.
All right, Kathy, thank you. Go ahead, Sandy.
I had a couple more overlooked deductions.
Yes, please.
That might make me go through. These are on miscellaneous itemized deductions on Schedule A. Mm-hmm. I review a lot of tax returns over a year's time. Some of the things would be investment planning and monitoring expenses there. And we often see, the cost of internet into the home, publications you read for business to monitor your investments, you often see there. Tax prep fees, what you pay your CPA to produce your return is often there. Sometimes we see things like the antivirus software for that laptop that you're using to monitor your investments. Or we see the desktop or the laptop or the tablet that you're using to monitor your investments. You'll see that there sometimes too.
Yeah. You're not pushing the margin there, are you?
No. That's between the clients and their CPA, what they, and that varies too.
Well, the IRS, is that right? Raise a flag with the IRS if you start taking deductions like that?
Well, it does qualify under investment monitoring expenses, and planning.
Okay.
Yes. You see it often.
Yeah.
It's not illegal, if that's what you're asking. No, it qualifies.
You can do it.
Yeah. Okay. Another odd one that most people don't think about is if you paid an estate planning attorney to draw up, a revocable trust and your pour over wills and your powers of attorney, you can go back and ask them what percent of their bill is related to production of income or for tax issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then lots of times you'll see something like, 10, 20, 30%. Every once in a while, an attorney will go higher than that. But, if you paid a couple grand this year to have that done, certain percent of those fees can get deducted in this section also.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, the amount of money that people are probably leaving on the table. So I hear you walk through these different deductions. I mean, man, it must be just a staggering amount of money that people leave out there every year.
Yeah.
And the best way to stay on top of all that is what? To know that you're getting, you're taking full advantage of all the deductions you can take advantage of.
I really would encourage people, because CPAs during tax season are just so very busy, you can't expect it of them. But, if they can book an appointment with their CPA during off season and just go in with a nice list of questions. We have, about 10 pages we go through our clients with on occasion to see if we're catching everything for them that we know they're using.
What about the advantage of paying an extra month of mortgage and taking the interest off your taxes versus making a charitable contribution, Lucas? Which one is going to give you the better benefit?
It depends on the amount, but I would think that the charitable contribution is probably going to be the extra piece there, or get you the better bump, because only a piece of your mortgage payment is going to go to interest.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
But you do still have the value of getting your mortgage paid off sooner, so it's kind of a trade-off.
Yeah, kind of a trade-off there. Okay, 816-235-2888. Let's go back to some calls here. And Jerry from Loan Jack. Jerry, you're on Up to Date.
Good morning, Steve. Steve, I was wondering about I-bonds, if your guests would have any information on I-bonds. Are they subject to the same type of devaluation with the interest rate rise as other bonds?
What's an I-bond? Do we even know? What is an I-bond? Jerry, help us here.
Ooh. what is an I-bond? Let me see. Pull one out here.
He's got one in your wallet there, right, Jerry?
I have a series of them, a series I. What is an I-bond?
It's
just the name of them, as far as I know.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's a bond that you buy through the U.S. Treasury that's going to have a interest rate that goes up or down based on an inflation basket or index. So it's a bond that has an inflation kind of tack on with it. So one of the reasons you might buy that is if you thought you were going into an inflationary environment and wanted to get an extra kicker on your bond because of higher inflation.
And I think that's his question. So the fact that interest rates are going up is actually a good thing with I bonds versus some other types of bonds.
So it's good news for you, Jerry. Merry Christmas.
Well, yeah. Merry Christmas. Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a good holiday, Jerry. I appreciate it. Thank you. Let's go to Steve from Independence. Steve, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to ask the opinion of converting traditional IRAs to over to Roth IRA, if that's a good long-range investor idea, or should I stay with my traditionals?
Explain what a traditional IRA is versus a Roth IRA here, Sandy.
With a traditional IRA, if you put money in, you usually get a deduction unless your income is way too high. With a Roth IRA, you don't get a deduction. But the advantage of a Roth IRA is that your money in there earns, they both grow tax deferred. You don't pay taxes while the money is growing. But the difference with the Roth IRA is that you don't pay taxes when you pull it out. With the IRA, you do pay taxes when you pull it out. And there's a couple of cases in terms of converting an IRA or to a Roth IRA. If you made a non-deductible contribution into that IRA, and it's the only, you know, IRAs that you have, you don't have any simple IRAs or anything like that, then yeah, that's a good idea, even if you're a high income earner, to go ahead and convert that over, because your cost basis is 100% of your market value.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason, case where it may make sense to do that, is if you're in a very low interest rate now, but you fully expect to be in a higher bracket down the road. So yeah, maybe it makes sense to go ahead and pay a little bit of tax now, and then you're home free, supposedly, for the rest of your life if the government doesn't change the rules.
You meant your tax rate, not your interest rate, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes,
yeah.
I did. But usually, though, most often, you don't pay the IRS early. So let's say you're in the 25, 28% bracket. You know, you'd really think twice before you want to convert that to a Roth this year.
Okay, Lucas?
Yeah, and just to add to that, I get these questions a lot, and I think it really boils down to a tax play. So if you're gonna pay a lower rate of tax on that money today than you would in the future, typically a Roth makes sense. Convert it now, pay the tax man now at a lower bracket, and then not have to pay that at a higher bracket down the road. If you're in the opposite situation, you're getting a higher tax bracket today and you might be in a lower one in retirement, it's probably not a great decision to go ahead with that Roth conversion now.
Huh. Okay. 816-23. Yeah, I appreciate your phone call, Steve. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're visiting with our financial planners this morning and taking your calls at 816-235-2888, some year-end financial advice that might be useful here. Brian from Lawrence. Brian, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. I have an IRA question as well. A different dilemma, though. I have a Roth and a regular IRA, and I had to take a different job, and I took a $16,000 a year pay cut and have not been able to pay into it for 2 years. And so I think there are managing fees coming out of it, and it's probably losing money. And I want to know how to make that. I want to change that situation.
All right. How about help for Brian?
I'm not quite sure where he has the IRA account that he's paying.
It's with Ameriprise.
Oh, I see. Well, you can do an IRA rollover to a different brokerage and manage it yourself, but you'll need to go back to where you are now and ask him if there are fees that you would pay if you moved your account.
Oh, Lucas? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the first place I'd go is I'd go back to your current advisor and have a conversation about, you know, the allocation and understand kind of how your money's invested and how that's, you know, part of an overall strategy. That's the first place I'd go. And then, you know, if you're comfortable with that strategy moving forward, great. If not, then I would, like Sandy said, you know, you can consider some other options.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, Brian, thank you. I appreciate that. Let's go to Sarb from Overland Park. Sarb, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Go ahead, Sarb.
So, for my new job, I have the choice to either go 1099 self-employed contractor or W-2
right.
Hourly with no benefits, or full-time salaried with benefits. This is a family of four, two kids. Which choice or option would work best for me?
It's not an easy answer. It's
1099 or a W-2. Yeah.
So you have to weigh it, because if you go the 1099 route, you're giving up something. So you should get something for that, because as a 1099, they're not going to be doing tax withholdings for you. You're not going to be part of the benefit package. So they should pay you more to make up for that. You know, so then you're taking some of the risk on yourself. You'll have to come up with your own 401k plan, your own disability and all this and that. That's not going to be group sponsored. If they're going to pay you enough money in addition to what they would have paid you as a W-2 to make up for that, then it makes sense to do the 1099. But it's not a simple decision. It's something that you need to probably talk to a financial advisor of some type to kind of guide you through what makes most sense based on your particular situations. And I don't think we have time for all your situations on the air here.
I hope that helps, sir.
Sure.
Okay, good luck.
I guess that's not what he wanted to hear, but it really is. It yeah. kind of depends. You know, some people would prefer the 1099 and say, pay me a lot more, and then I'll do it myself. But, you're giving up something by being a 1099 versus
you have to buy your own medical, your own life.
Right.
You know, your own pension.
You know, Sandy, a lot of folks this time of year get year-end bonuses of one kind or another. What should they be thinking about if they're picking up a big chunk of cash here at the end of the year?
You know, your financial planner's dream would be that you put that into your pension plan at work.
Yeah.
You know, if you're self-employed, you know, set up a SEP plan as soon as you can before, you know, you could put it in that way. It's too late to get a simple pension set up. But, you know, if you have a pension plan at work and you haven't maxed out yet, we'd love for you to get it in there.
How busy are you guys this time of year? I mean, people with all kinds of year-end questions. It's really crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is crazy. Yeah.
And it continues all the way through tax season, I imagine, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, yeah, at least into January, you know, it gets busy. But, you know, everybody's trying to get their charitable gifts in at the last minute or their gifts. You know, the high-income bracket parents are trying to get gifts down into the children, the next generation level, the adult children with the lower tax brackets, you know, trying to get that done. And then, you know, you do want to get, you know, your IRAs are a continuing thing, even though that you do have a longer deadline on that. But, yeah.
Dad, are you listening? I hope my dad's listening right now. Good time for Dad to be thinking about that. Yeah. Lucas, you're going to throw something else here, Lucas? Or yeah.
No, I think the conversation is really good on the kind of the year-end stuff. I think the thing to think about with the retirement plan on the bonus is you know, if you haven't maxed out your 401k, you usually have an opportunity to bump that up and do a higher percentage. And I always suggest folks, you know, really consider, you know, putting away 10 or 20% of that bonus. You don't feel it because you still get a nice check where you can use for holiday spending or whatever, but it really helps you either catch up or get ahead on the retirement savings piece.
Retirement savings, you know, the number I keep hearing kicking around among my friends, when I was younger, it used to be $500,000. Now I'm hearing million. I got to have $1 million to even be in the conversation. Does that sound right? Even north of there?
You know, yeah. I mean, I think $1 million isn't what it used to be. And
don't be saying that.
That's
yeah.
so true. So true. You know, the right answer there is it depends on what your lifestyle expectation is in retirement. But I think $500,000 really isn't going to get you that far. You know, and Social Security is one of those things we could do a whole show on talking about whether those benefits are going to be there and at what level. But I think the more you can put away for retirement, the better off and the more flexibility you will have in terms of maintaining your lifestyle down the road.
Yeah, if you're one of those lucky employees who has a pension, then, you know, the million is not that big a deal. You don't really need the million because you got that pension that you're counting on. So it really does depend on your situation.
Man, we talked on this show before, but there's going to be a lot of people out there who aren't anywhere close to $1 million or north of $1 million, much less having said that.
They'll work a little bit longer.
Yeah, just keep going. We're talking with our financial planners today, running through some year-end financial advice. If you want to get in the final minutes of the show, do so. Give us a call right now. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Option two is to tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Chris from Stillwell on the Kansas side. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. My question is, if I retire from my company with its 401k where they don't charge me any fees for administering it, would I be better off to just leave it in there and arrange for payments out of it, or would I be better off to roll it over into another 401k?
David?
Well, that's another one of those questions where it depends. If cost is your only barometer, then yeah, leave it in the 401k because it is definitely cheaper. If you want to have a few more investment options, then it makes more sense to roll it over. If you want financial advice, if you want somebody to kind of guide you with your investment portfolio decisions, then it makes sense to roll it over. But if all you're looking at is costs, then yeah, the 401k is the best place. But then 401ks are not generally designed to take income from. Mm-hmm. They're more designed for you to add money to as opposed to pulling money out. So you may have to take a look at that.
And one of the things
things
you should really ask and drill into is whether there are indeed some fees on the 401k. That this is something that you know the Department of Labor is weighing in right now, and there's a lot of debate in the industry. But you know, oftentimes there are fees in the 401ks. You just don't see them on your statement.
True enough.
So sometimes those get baked in different areas, you know, potentially through higher costs on the investments. Sometimes it's just an annual fee that comes out and not a monthly fee. So if I were you, I would suggest going in and talking to your 401k provider or your employer and really understanding the fee piece before you just assume there's no fees baked in.
Yeah, you make a really valid point there because there are a lot of fees in 401ks. It's become a really hot topic in our industry that people don't see, so they need to understand.
Yeah.
You can go to www.morningstar.com and look up the investment choices inside your 401k. And this man was talking about an old 401k rolling forward to a new 401k. But he could look at the choices in the old and choices in the new and see which ones were less expensive.
You know, lots of folks are exchanging gifts this time of year. What about the notion of, you know, instead of a toy or a gadget, you know, something less traditional, cash or shares of stock? And I should give up my address at this point in the show if people are thinking here. But what kind of advice would you toss out there in terms of maybe non-traditional gift giving this time of year?
Yeah, I think it's something that I encourage a lot of people to consider. And it seems like the grandparents are the ones that are most interested in this. I mean, you know, kids get so many toys these days, it seems like, that, you know, what's just one more set of Legos or another toy?
Yeah.
And so you can potentially pass on some money values to your grandkids or even to your kids and do some giving in other ways. You know, a cash gift is obviously a nice one that you can, you know, either help them with a specific expense or, you know, help get them on a better financial footing. One thing that I really encourage grandparents to consider is making a 529 plan contribution, which is an education savings account, a tax-advantaged account.
Does the grandparent get the tax break then?
Yeah, they would if they make the contribution. But the bigger piece is you're kind of helping set that kid up for college. And you know, they may not appreciate that gift quite as much now as the kind of the short-term sugar fix with a toy. You know, but down the road, that money should grow for them and create an opportunity to help them with
I love the
life.
Commercial where the kid gets the 529 plan statement out on Christmas and they're like, what is this? Like, seriously?
Yeah, doesn't do me any good right now, does it? You can't spend it, son, for 18 years. Suzanne from Leewood. Suzanne, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just am worried about your using the term financial advisor versus certified financial planner. I got into a lot of trouble with the self-dealing of a financial advisor.
Yeah. Who, David, what's the difference?
Well, it's really, I'm glad she brought that up because it's an interesting topic, because just about anybody can call themselves a financial advisor, whether you're an insurance person, a tax person, or just a salesperson, you can call yourself a financial advisor. A certified financial planner, on the other hand, is somebody who has been gone through a lot of education. We're constantly monitored as far as continuing education. And, you know, so there is a huge difference. And we're all here as certified financial planners.
Isn't there something about fiduciary responsibility?
Absolutely. Yeah, which means
so it's
that
huge.
Yeah, we're actually
huge distinction.
We're charged with looking out for our clients' best interest versus, you know, what's going to make money for us. So she makes a really valid point.
Thanks, Suzanne. I appreciate it.
Okay, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Christmas. Bye-bye. Let's go to Bob from Prairie Village. Bob, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. Question. Well, first of all, you might verify this, but I'm the executor on my brother's estate, and I presume that any TOD investments that he has, a TOD to me, will have a increased basis or change basis at the time of his death, should that happen. My actual question is that we also have bonds with my name and his name on it as co-owners. Is that taxable to the estate or to me at such time as he dies?
Sandy?
Is that joint with the right of survivorship on the bonds, the title? Then it just flows to you then at his death.
You're saying that first of all, the TOD is no problem. What I assume is correct. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, now, as far as the bonds are concerned, the names are on there simply as co-owners, if I'm not mistaken. Is that what happens with U.S. I and E bonds?
I know about double E bonds, but
Well, I would think I bonds would be the same way as double E's.
Yes, they go to you as far as a step up in basis at death, though. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, there's
I would
no step up in basis in that instance, is there? Because these bonds have not, the taxes haven't been prepaid, so at the time that they're cashed, the interest will be become taxable.
Okay.
Okay, so is that interest payable by me since my name is on it rather than the estate? In other words, can I refuse to accept the bonds and have them go back to the estate and have the state pay the taxes?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you know, Lucas?
Lucas?
I don't know the answer to that, but I've in these kind of really detailed questions, I do find that the Treasury is actually really good at giving you advice on that. So the Treasury website, I think it's called Treasury Direct, which is where basically the online presence of the U.S. Treasury to buy bonds. They've got a really good customer service number, and generally speaking, calling into a government agency for customer service isn't the best experience. My experience with them has been good, and I'd suggest you give them a call, and they should be able to walk you through the nuances of those. Because you may have a choice. There may be a lot of different angles here.
I know on double E bonds, when you change ownership, like one person dies, then it triggers the tax.
Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all our phone calls here today. Howard and Bob and Joe, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to you here. I want to thank Lucas Butchell, a principal with KHC Wealth Management, Sandy Weaver, a CPA and owner of Financial Security Advisors, and David Jackson with the Financial Planning Association. Happy holidays to all of you. Thanks
hey,
very
great
much.
Great to be with you, Steve. Merry Christmas.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, a topic I'm a little more familiar with. The political pundits join us for a look at the big issues of 2015. They'll give us some insight into what will make political headlines next year. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Lisa Rodriguez, and Beth Lipoff. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.